it's important to get out and you know, let the world change you. You know, it's like, it's, I think it's an important part of learning, you know, going to a country where you don't speak a language and going through that and learning that changes your perspective on things pretty quick.
Today on Dirty Linen, we are heading all the way across the country to Perth. I love visiting Perth, if only on the podcast, soon in real life. We are chatting today to Chef Paul Bentley, who grew up cooking in Perth, or that's where he started, but he spent a lot of time over in the US, in Europe, and in Mexico, where he owns restaurants, also in Hawaii. Paul, you've got it all going on. I'm looking forward to hearing about what you're doing in Perth these days at Sea Paradiso and at Casa. But firstly, welcome to Dirty Linen.
Thanks for having me.
You have had such an interesting career, so many different places, different restaurants, different cuisines. When people ask you to just, explain what you do, what you're all about, what do you say?
Well-traveled. that's probably a good place to start. I don't know. It's. I've never really liked to have anything sort of pigeonholed, and I think that's indicative of the menus that we run at Sea Paradiso and then now at Casa. I think it's, I mean, especially at Casa, it's more of a distillation of life experiences is probably the best way to put it.
Oh, that sounds so interesting and tasty immediately. Give us an example. Like, how does that actually, what kinds of dishes talk about what kinds of life experiences?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so obviously I started off with, I left school when I was 15 and then started an apprenticeship at a place here in Perth that won a bunch of awards and stuff like that, but very classical French. And then from there to France, from France to New York, sort of got into a bit of Italian food in New York, and then from there to Mexico. And in Mexico, we ended up owning a ramen bar and a few other different things. And then I guess the food at Casa is more so at Casa. It's food that we'd like to eat with wine. But it can be European based. There's, when it's warmer weather, there's obviously a lot more Mexican influence in it. At the end of the day, we just try to have fun, tasty food, you know? For example, we had a version of like roast chicken and chips here, but instead of the traditional gravy and everything, it was made with a homemade mole sauce.
Love that. That sounds so good. And what about at Sea Paradiso? What's the vibe there?
It's obviously more Italian directed, because of the pizzas that we do there. And obviously, I mean, the pizzas are great. So rather than try to create a menu that competes with that, everything has to be a complement to that. So, you know, it's a given that people are going to have a couple of pizzas. So small, fun, tasty snacks that go in and around, you know, that whole idea of people sharing a couple of pizzas.
Because the pizzas, I mean, I've, you know, love looking at the images of those pizzas on Instagram. I mean, can you talk us through some of the toppings? Because they're not your standard pizza joint kind of vibe.
No, I mean, there's a couple of classic ones on there, but I mean, obviously it's everything we try to do is using the best quality products we can get. In the dough there at the start, it's like a 96-hour process to get the dough to the point where we want it. And then, I mean, it goes all over the place. We had a lockdown and one of the lockdowns for COVID, we had a bunch of oysters. So we cured and smoked all the oysters. We ended up doing like a smoked oyster pizza with bonito flakes and togarashi, or it'll go to a version of a Hawaiian pizza, but with nuduya, mortadella, pineapple chutney, just spins on classic flavors, but done in our own way.
Oh yeah, nduja and pineapple chutney. I mean, that is just that when you, it's so kind of radical, but when you say it, it sounds like so obvious in a way. It's definitely going to work with that spice and that sweetness and the acid. It's just
it's a definite yes to pineapple on pizza always.
Oh, we love a bit of controversy on the podcast, so I'm glad to hear you say that. So Paul, am I right in thinking that you left Perth at the end of 1999 and then it was more or less the pandemic that saw you come back to live in Perth again?
Yeah, it was I never planned to come back. And then like I ended up, I've just sold all the stuff that I had in Mexico. I've still got the project in Hawaii, but I was literally for probably for the last 5 years before the pandemic, I'd come back for 6 weeks for holiday time, see my, like eat around, see some friends over east, and then come home, see my family, and then go. And we were actually meant to be doing a pop-up in Tokyo for the Olympics with the taquerias that we have in Hawaii. So like over Christmas, we could see that things were getting a little bit weird in China. And then I booked a one-way ticket to Hawaii, and I was in Hawaii for about 10 days, and I was meant to be in Sydney, I think it was like the 12th of March. So literally the day before, I bought a one-way ticket, and I landed in Sydney on the 12th of March. And yeah, it was like domino effect. Everything sort of started to get closed down. And then obviously my parents were like, well, the border's going to close. I didn't believe them. And then I checked on the news. So I flew straight back to WA. And then, yeah, after being here for a few months, I'm like, well, if I leave and something happens to them or my brother, like I can't get back into the country. And I was sort of looking for a change anyway. So I guess COVID forced my hand.
Wow. It's such a massive life change. I mean, how have you sort of reconciled to that? It's so different, you know, doing all the globe hopping that you were doing to, yeah, being in Perth.
I mean, it is. It probably took me 2 years to really be being back for 2 years to actually be comfortable with the decision. But Perth has changed a lot too. The Perth that I knew when I left to the Perth that's here now has evolved. In terms of food, there's still a long way to go. There's still some food trends and things that I wish would just disappear, but they haven't. But it's a work in progress. And actually being back is not so bad. I guess for me personally, I was probably looking for something a little bit more grounded. I was looking to leave Mexico anyway and maybe base myself in Hawaii. But I wasn't 100% sure on that decision. And then I was like, okay, you know. Then COVID happened and sort of, like I said, it forced my hand.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, is it a tricky balance? I'm sure you feel like, you know, you've seen a lot, you've learned a lot while you've been overseas. Is it a tricky balance between, I suppose, you know, being humble and open to what Perth has to offer, but also sharing the things that you're able to bring from, yeah, your vast experience elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, like honestly, like I mean, I think that's a good part of it. Obviously, I've got like a young apprentice now here at CASA, and it's, I guess, to be able to pass on what I've learned and obviously have an impact on what's going on where I'm from. That, you know, it's nice. It's, you know, I guess it's more fulfilling in that sense. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that's more important. All the awards and all the accolades and everything don't really mean anything. They're not as fulfilling as something like that. I mean, it's definitely on the fulfillment end of the scale. It's definitely more fulfilling being able to bring something to the table like that.
And what about things that have excited you about WA? Like, is there produce that you that perhaps wasn't coming through, you know, in the late 90s that you just like, whoa, this is, you know, really amazing now?
There's definitely a lot of produce that excites me. There's a lot of stuff that's sort of spruiked a bit in the media. That's not. But I mean, definitely like some of the scallops, some of the produce. Ben Pithick, one of the local fishermen, like the whole process that he takes and the care that he takes with the fish. I mean, it's incredible. Like some of the local cheeses. It's actually a really exciting time. You know, it's like. When I was first here and doing my apprenticeship, it was all you would ever hear was everything in Europe is better. And I think in Australia, we struggled for a long time to have our own food identity. And I don't think we have one. Like it's not like if you, for example, if you go to Italy, you go to France, you go to Mexico, you go to Asia, there's such a depth of food in their culture for so many years. We don't have that in Australia. So we've been taking little bits and pieces from here and there, and that's okay. Like for a long time, people weren't okay with that and you know, sort of struggled with that misidentity. And I think that's okay, you know. It's okay not to have that. Don't pretend that you do and just, you know, just try and cook good food and be creative.
Yeah, definitely. I think there are advantages in being able to take elements from all kinds of different cuisines and cultures.
Yeah. I mean, you're not, you're not bound by rules, you know, like there was so many places that I worked and it's like, you can't do this because it's not classic French, or you can't do this because it's not this. And it's like, well, why not? It's like, if it tastes good, why not? You know?
Well, that instantly makes me want to chat to you about Danielle, the flagship restaurant in New York from Daniel Ballou, where I understand you were sous chef, and I guess that's a, you know, a pretty classic restaurant. I'd love you to just give us an insight into that kitchen and what it was like to work there.
Minimum 16 hours a day. Everything, obviously, at that point they were 3 Michelin stars, so. It was interesting because I started there in the year after 9/11. So before they used to have lunch and dinner, and then they stopped doing lunch. So you'd have like a crew earlier in the morning to do prep. That sort of went away. So it was a smaller crew for Danielle standards, but you were still starting 7:38 in the morning, right the way through to 12 at night most days, 6 days a week. A lot of pressure, very intense. But, you know, in some sense, I think that's sort of missing a little bit nowadays from the whole food industry. I think people are a little bit afraid to go down that road and push. Like, there was a lot of stuff that you had to deal with. Like, it's like I say to my cooks here sometimes, it's like, listen, was I the best cook at Daniel? No, dude, there was 10, 12, 13 people that were probably better than me, but the difference is they couldn't handle the pressure. Does that make them right? Does it make me better than them or not? Not really. But when you deal with that and you overcome that pressure, like, you get more sense of fulfillment. I think people now want everything instant. They don't want to work for it. So, like, in that sense, I think it's important for people to go through an experience like that. I mean, I was there 3 years, so it was a very intense 3 years. Obviously, the number of covers you could walk in on the first day of the week and do 300 covers on a Monday, and it has to be high standard.
What are some dishes or techniques that you remember from that period that you've been able to, I guess, you know, they're part of your story now?
I guess it was more like I already had a very good base of classic French food when I went there, so it was more polishing that. I think in New York, there's so much pressure to succeed. I think that's an important part of the New York experience. For example, you can create something and then the next day there's 20 other restaurants doing the same thing. So there's that constant pressure to evolve. There's that constant pressure to maintain perfection, which I think is iconic to that part of New York experience. I mean, there were some dishes that I really remember, but it's more so for the quantity of those dishes we had to do. I remember we did an event, an offsite catering event for 1,000 people, and we had to like tunnel bone 1,000 quails that were then filled with a fig wrapped in prosciutto, wrapped in spinach with a piece of seared foie gras, like inside. So there was a few things like that. It was more in grand. I remember one week we braised about 1,000 kilos of short ribs too for like 2 offsite events. So there was on top of everything else, there was that. But I mean, I think for me, it was just a constant pursuit of perfection that was the thing that I took away from it.
Yeah, it's so interesting, you know, because you talk about the pressure and how, you know, the 12 or 13 cooks that were, you know, preceded you perhaps just couldn't handle that pressure. And you think, well, you thrived, you know, I'm sure it was tough, but, you know, you took something from it, you appreciated the good things about it. But I just think about, you know, what about those 12 or 13 guys that it broke? You know, like, it's like, that's not good.
There was a lot more than 12 or 13. It's like, I mean, listen, the thing in New York, and there was one interesting thing that I took away from it. It's there, for example, if you didn't want to do the job, there was 100 other people that were dying for that one opportunity to get in there and do it. And then leaving that and then opening my own businesses, like, the way that you deal and manage people, like, had to take a complete 180 because there wasn't 100 people lined up waiting to come and work for me. But I don't think that's a reason to take the foot off the accelerator and not push or not look for strive for perfection or strive to be better. I mean, it's like, for me, it's like, okay, I'll do something and it'll be great, but you can tell me that it's an amazing dish and I can straight away find 20 things that I don't like about it. So I think being there and going through that sort of situation, you get that auto filter. And you know, it's, you learn to take criticism, which is kind of important in the hospitality as well. And like I said, it's like that self-fulfillment. If you can do it, you can get through it. Well, there's nothing that you can't do, you know?
Mm, yeah. I mean, tell me about Mexico, because I imagine, you know, the experience of running businesses and kitchens there must have been so different to New York.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, the biggest experience was people aren't working there to get it on a resume. They're working there just as a job. There's the challenge of learning a different language, obviously, running businesses in a very corrupt country. That was kind of fun. I think there was just a challenge on a different set, you know, but obviously based on what I'd learned and done in the past, I mean, I ended up owning 9 businesses in a foreign country. So it's, you know, it, I mean, I always like to look for a challenge. I like that element of craziness in my life. I think I thrive in that sort of high pressure, crazy zone. And you know, I've sort of looked for those situations, I guess, and excelled in them.
So, yeah, I mean, you spoke about, you know, how rewarding it is to, you know, help school up your apprentice in Perth, but what do you think generally about Australian kitchen culture and that, I guess, that balance between striving for excellence, but also so many people now are looking for a bit more work-life balance. Mental health is a huge discussion. Like, how do you, you know, and of course, you know, think about the prices that someone would be prepared to pay at somewhere like Danielle compared to the prices people would pay in Australia. I mean, that is a huge part of it. Obviously, Mexico is another story again. So basically, yeah, how do you think it all shakes down?
I mean, I think the hospitality system in Australia, like, is in need of a bit of attention. Wages, for example, I think that there should be a higher wage across the board, but do away with double time, triple time, and all those sort of things. I mean, at the end of the day, you get into hospitality, and you know you're going to have to work weekends. You know you're going to have to work public holidays. Like, it's a given. It's part of the job. It just makes it really hard for people to have a business. So I think there needs to be a better balance between those two. Like, obviously, you know, you could pay people a higher fairer wage across the board, but do away with those things that penalize a business. You know, I think it's got to be beneficial to both sides. In general, like, I think there's a great work ethic in Australia. I think some of the younger generations of cooks want it a lot easier than it has to be. Like, it's, you know, it's, I learned the hard way, and I'm not for going down that road, but there's definitely a larger sense of entitlement. And like anything, cooking is one of those things that you've got to put your time in, you know, just because you're straight out of culinary school or straight out of qualified, or you've seen a few episodes of something on YouTube, doesn't mean you can run a kitchen or doesn't mean that you can create something and put it on a menu. It's years of repetition, years of building a palate, years of practice. I mean, you know, point in case, learning to make sushi. It's what, 5 years of making rice before you even allowed to touch the fish. So, you know, it's, there's something to be said for like mastering something over a longer period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, were you shown that early in your career? I mean, there must have been, yeah, like, what kind of mentors did you have early on, or, you know, what lit you up about it when you left school at 15 to start working in kitchens?
Yeah, I mean, I hated school. Like, I was a total troublemaker and I hated school. So this was my out, and I was already washing dishes in a restaurant part-time. So, the place that I did my apprenticeship was, like, this old-school French place, like the Loose Box. It was, like, really in the heyday. Like, Elaine was a total hard ass. Like, you'd get shit thrown at you, sauces pouring down your jacket. Like, it was the hard yards. And I mean, but then Elaine has turned out to be probably one of my biggest mentors, and not only a mentor, a friend. you know, over the years. Most chefs that I've worked for are like that. So, you know, I think it's important.
Yeah. It's just so interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming / hoping that you're not pouring sauces down anyone's jacket these days.
No. It's like I said, like I learned that way. And the thing that I've learned, it's very few people can deal with that and come out of the other side. So you've got to strike a balance between the two. You know, if you've got to repeat things over and over and over and over again, well, you know, that person probably shouldn't be working in that position. You know, but you've got to take the time and you've got to culture and create the staff that you want. You know, you've got to believe in them. You've got to give them some belief in themselves. But everything's a balance game.
I'm also really curious for you to tell me which food trends you think we need to kill right here, right now.
Microgreens, like I thought they should have died off. Microgreens and flowers on food. Like unless you have a restaurant where it's you're growing everything and then you're growing everything on the farm and maybe you get some beautiful like rocket flowers or something in season. But like, yeah, I thought that trend would have gone away a very, 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 very long time ago. Tweezers and food, not really a fan. Little dots and magic powders in food either, not really a fan. Yeah, real food, real flavor. I you know, for me that's important. You know, it's I think there's a lot to be said for just well-cooked food done well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously you love to be busy, you love challenges. You've got two restaurants that you're looking after in Perth at the moment, but now that you've got rid of the businesses in Mexico, I feel like there must be more things on your horizon. What else have you got planned?
Yeah, there is. We actually have the space next door to Casa that we've got something going on there. And then, yeah, we'll see. I mean, now that I'm sort of here in Perth, yeah, I'm definitely not going to sit still. There's a few more things that I want to do in terms of businesses here. And then, yeah, it's just keep on moving forward.
I think Mexican food in Australia, you know, it's always, I guess, a big conversation. You know, it can't be truly authentic. How authentic does it need to be? Who should be cooking it? I mean, where do you think Mexican food is in Australia?
I mean, for me, for example, like, the only places, well, the only restaurants I had that did Mexican food were outside of Mexico, and the guys who work there are actually Mexican. For me, like we do, like I lived in Mexico 10 years, and I don't cook traditional Mexican food. I never profess to cook traditional Mexican food. My grandmother never made a mole, and dishes like that. So it's my interpretation of that food. After living there 10 years. So that's the way that we sell it. If I ever did a Mexican concept and here, like I'd probably bring someone from Mexico to do it because Jose from Puebla tells a better story than Chad from Scarborough, for example. food has to be authentic. Food has to be honest. It has to be authentic. And even after living there 10 years, it's like I said, I don't think I'm qualified to say that I cook authentic Mexican food, you know, but having said that, I like to keep it in line with what is, you know, with what I saw over there. You know, I'm not trying to like do some diluted version of my interpretation or something, of a dish that I had. I'm just, you know, I'm going to cook it as true to the way it should be.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me that it just makes me excited to think about Australian cuisine and all the opportunities that we've got here to, just excite people with different flavours and ideas be respectful. But, of course, yeah, you can't cook every cuisine the way that it might be in its country of origin in Australia. Yeah. So it's...
And I think if you're honest about that up front, like that's fine, you know, as long as you're not trying to sell it as being authentic. I mean, that's fine too. You know, it's never going to be, but the moment that you start to try to wave that flag, that's where things sort of go wrong. Like I said, food at the end of the day is something very honest. So, you know, the moment that you sort of try to do something that that's not, or I mean, you know, it never works out.
And I mean, Perth's been through such a particular experience over the past couple of years. Do you feel like, you know, coming out of those border closures, out of that extreme isolation, that, you know, the city is having a real moment? Do you feel like there's a lot of promise in the future for Perth?
I mean, I do. I think a lot of people came back from overseas, like myself. So that's always a good thing. And hopefully, like, a lot of people will take the opportunity to leave and travel. You know, there's unfortunately, there's still a lot of people here that are like, I've never left Perth, and they're proud of that fact. That mentality needs to be broken. Like, it's important to get out and, you know, let the world change you. You know, it's like, it's, I think it's an important part of learning, you know, going to a country where you don't speak a language and going through that and learning that changes your perspective on things pretty quick. So, you know, it's like, hopefully now that people have been locked up for 2.5 years, they'll take that opportunity to leave and go and see the world and, you know, go and experience stuff in different countries, cultures, food, everything.
Yeah, love it. I'm so surprised to hear that there are people who are proud that they've never explored, but okay.
I was talking to someone about a friend of mine about this today. I'm like, someone was telling this the other day, and I was just like, wow, that's not something that I'd be very proud of, dude. Like, it's, yeah, there's a whole big world outside of Perth.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, it's really been a thrill to chat to you and learn more about your career and your perspective on hospitality. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
No, I think we've pretty much covered it.
All right. Well, what's on the menu this week at Casa? What are you excited about cooking?
What have we got? We actually probably changed some stuff this week. We've got a new dish with some local stracciatella that'll probably be going on. There's a new mushroom dish going on with there's some guys here that grow mushrooms here locally. The mushroom guys, they've got some pretty interesting product. There's the menu here is always in a constant state of evolution. So, I mean, that's kind of exciting. You know, it's I get bored really easy. So the menu needs to change a lot, to keep me occupied.
Love it. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today, Paul. It's been really great to hear your stories.
No worries. Thank you.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you. This.